Blog Talk Radio.
I'll do whatever I can.
All right, welcome. You're live, Tina. Welcome to Relationship Marketing. This is Rhonda Del Baccio, the story lady. And Tina will be here momentarily. We are excited to have a special guest with us today, who is John Creamer, and he is definitely big into building relationships with people. And hang on one second, folks. I'm trying to read a message real quick and provide some assistance to Gina. So give me just a second here. Okay, hang on one second. Little technical issues every so often do. So, 1 minute here. And so, as each week we're bringing you somebody awesome, this is an interesting little start, but we will get things up and running for you here in just a second. I've got to grab something, so we're getting Gina in. And every so often, when you're doing live stuff, interesting things happen. So, but there we go. So we have with us John Creamer, and his website is bookmarket.com. And John is a best-selling author. He has what I call the Bible of book marketing. It is definitely large. Ah, here we go.
Hello, Rhonda. Hello, John.
Hey.
Sorry, I got locked out of my own toe.
Weird happened. Sorry about that, Gina. It was a bit of a rough start for you. I apologize. We're glad to have you.
I guess you didn't get my instant message earlier from my phone. I'll have to not do that when it's so close to showtime. So, hello, John. How are you?
Hey, I'm great.
Glad that you could be here.
I'm glad you could, too.
So am I.
Ah, you know, that's what I love about this show, Rhonda. We're always so laid back. So let me just tell everybody that my new co-host is Rhonda Del Baccio, the story lady from ProfitableStorytelling.com, and I'm so glad that she's going to be with me every week.
I'm so excited. I'm loving it. Gina, I'm ecstatic to have this opportunity to serve with you each week. It is a lot of fun, especially when the technology works in our favor, but hey.
Hey, I will save this number so I can figure out how to get in next week if I need to.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's cool. So anyway, yeah, we're excited. I think we're all sorted out now.
And I had this nice little intro for John all prepared.
Well, go on ahead and do it, because I was trying to read a instant message without my speech program and kind of sounding like an idiot at the beginning, so go right ahead.
Well, I have been really excited about this week's show since Rhonda told me that she was able to bring John in as a guest, because we got to meet at JV Alert in Orlando, I think it was in February, and he's been someone that I've admired for years. So our guest today is John Creamer, a book marketing consultant. His clients include a self-published author who's sold over 2 million books, a new age publisher with 60 titles, and a general publisher with a rapidly growing list of 1,500 titles. Book marketing expert John Creamer consults in the areas of book marketing, book sales, book promotion, publicity, direct marketing, pricing, book titles, book covers, book marketing plans, and so much more for publishers of all sizes as well as for individual authors. Among other services, he provided the strategy that took Deepak Chopra from a Vanity Press author to being on the New York Times bestseller list 8 separate times. Jack Canfield and Mark Victor Hansen, authors of Chicken Soup for the Soul, credit John's book, 1001 Ways to Market Your Books, as the guiding light for their rise to bestseller status. John's consulting clients have gotten stories in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Newsweek, Scientific American, Chicago Tribune, as well as featured on Oprah, Today Show, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, and many other local and national broadcast shows. He is certainly the kind of a guy that really understands relationship marketing in order to get such stellar results for his clients. So I am so glad to welcome John Kramer here with us on Relationship Marketing 101 today. Thanks so much, John, for being here.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Gina.
So, Rhonda, what should we pick John's brain about today?
Oh, well, my goodness. I think that, you know, the thing that I really appreciate so much about John is that, yes, of course, he has all kinds of fabulous book marketing, if you will, tricks up his sleeve and all kinds of strategies and whatever. But what John is really awesome with is this whole idea of building relationships, and what he teaches is not only useful in book marketing, so it means if you're an author, great, obviously he'll help you, but even if you are someone who is not an author or not yet an author, and if you're not, talk to us, but he has strategies that will really be helpful to you. So, John, I really want to pick your brain in terms of the things that you teach to help people to build relationships.
Well, I mean, to me, the key is that relationships. I'm getting an echo.
Yeah, I hear that a little bit.
Do you hear that also?
I do. Rhonda, are you on a headset, or what kind of a thingy are you on today?
Well, I'm not sure what I can do about it, but carry on, and I'll see what I can do. I'm not hearing.
Okay.
It seemed to have gone away now, John.
Yeah.
Okay.
With relationships, you know, it finally hit me about 10 years ago, may have been a little bit longer than that, that all of marketing is really relationship building. It's creating relationships. It took me a while to really realize and identify that. I was doing it all along, but it suddenly hit me that everything I was doing in marketing books was actually building relationships, whether it was with the bookstores, distributors, media, or, you know, now in today's world, the Internet. And so it became really important to think about that. And when I talked to authors about it, I have to tell them something more than that. I have to say that it's not just creating relationships, it's making friends. Because most authors are afraid of creating relationships, but they know how to create friends. So I often talk about it now in terms of making friends, because most people know how to do that. Creating relationships can sometimes be an intimidating thing. You know, how am I going to get to know this producer at Oprah or whatever? And the fact of the matter is that the way that you get to know somebody is you see them enough times that, you know, you become friends. If you don't see them, if you don't interact with them, you have no chance to create a relationship. And so a lot of what is involved in creating relationships is just being out there, getting exposed to people over and over again. And then ideally, at some point, obviously, you'd want that opportunity to meet the people live, just like, you know, I met both of you at JV Alert in Orlando back in February. And that's a nice extra touch. But, I mean, I've had a lot of relationships in my business world that with people that I've never actually met physically, but who came to rely on our interaction in some way, including a top reporter for the New York Times who reported on the publishing industry. And, you know, those kinds of relationships I think are golden. And I think
well, and just because you haven't met them in person doesn't mean that you don't have a relationship with them. Some of my best, strongest relationships, those that I value the most too, are with people I've never met face to face.
Right, and you know, when you're online, especially like with my book marketing network on Ning, and in Twitter, I've met a number of people that I've, you know, in essence, fallen in love with, but who I've never actually met. One of the people that I love is Paulo Coelho, and we've only interacted by email a number of times. I've posted blogs about him a number of times.
Oh, he's awesome.
I love the man. I love his writing. I love what he's doing. But, you know, I've never met him. There's another man, Dr. Mani, from India that I've never met, but I like what he's doing. And he seems to like what I'm doing, you know. So you get those kinds of relationships that you begin to build over time. And then you end up talking to them on the phone or something like that, or in a internet radio show, or another kind of interview, or maybe you do a blog post for them or things like that, or they do a blog post about you. You know, every time I search my name somewhere, I'm amazed at how many people are writing about me at some point or another. And honored.
Yeah, and I love your approach about making friends and that being something that pretty much anyone understands. You know, and I have actually kind of a funny story about that. I know an author who has a book about relationships, and that's the work that she does, and yet when I talk to her about building relationships with people for your business, it was like, how do you do that? What are you talking about? How does that? Like, well, same way that you do it in other areas of your life, really. You know, you strike up conversations, you find ways to be interesting to them, you know, you make friends, whatever. So it's funny how just thinking about it as a relationship, that language does get in people's way, John. I think you're right.
You know, and the thing is, you know, it really isn't that complicated. When you think about, you know, Oprah and her relationship with her audience, I mean, she definitely has a relationship with everybody that watches her show. Yet she's probably met, like, you know, 1/1000th of 1/1000% of something or other of the people that actually follow her. But she has a relationship. Everybody that watches her show believes they have a relationship with her. You know, and I think that's neat when you can do that, especially on something like TV, where it seems to be very separate from, you know, the people who are watching. Yet she has created that relationship. And I think we can do the same thing in terms of just our exposure to whoever our audience is. You start to build a relationship. It amazes me how many times I get an email from somebody that says, I've been a fan of yours for years. And I said, well, why didn't you tell me sooner? I can always use the boost, you know. But, you know, at least, you know, several times a week, you know, one of my subscribers to my email newsletter will write to me and say, you know, I really appreciate what you've been doing and what you've been sharing. It always lifts me every week when I get this. It's a great start to a new day. And, you know, those things are really helpful to those of us who provide information and inspiration, because, you know, for the most part, you know, we're sitting at home in our garret, in our warehouse, wherever we are, interacting on the computer and so on, but we don't always get the feedback that, hey, you're doing good work. You know, fortunately, I'm naive enough to think I'm doing it anyway, so I keep doing it, but it does help to have the feedback. And it really does make a difference in terms of just that simple email to me means that my relationship with that person has strengthened. And you can do the same thing with anybody that you email or blog about. I mean, you know, it's amazing how many times I blogged about somebody and they say, oh, I didn't know you had noticed my work. You know, thank you. And you start to build a relationship with somebody famous. You comment on their blog post or something like that. I mean, one of my favorite people right now is Jonathan Gunson of cafepress.tv, I think it is. I love his work, you know, and we've only met via email and Twitter so far. But, I love his work. And somewhere along the line, you know, maybe he'll do a TV show about me on his network.
That would be really cool.
Yeah, and you just never know when that kind of thing happens. But it's wonderful when it does. I mean, you know, I've had a long-standing relationship with Jack Canfield and Mark Victor Hansen, but it all started when I heard them speak a number of years ago before the first Chicken Soup for the Soul book came out. They told one story from the book, and I had tears streaming down my face. And I knew that, you know, I was going to buy multiple copies. And then the next year at ABA, at Book Expo, I actually saw them autographing. And this was at the time when HCI had a one-booth booth, you know. Now they have like 20 booths or something like that. But and they were autographing, and I go up into the line, and Jack asked me, who should I autograph this to? And I say, John Kramer. And he says, are you that John Kramer? And I said, it depends. It wasn't clear yet whether or not he was happy with that John Kramer or not.
Right.
But I said, yes, I probably am. And then he said, Mark, you got to come over here. This is John Kramer. And, you know, and from there on, we built the relationship. It still took me another year to get the, testimonial from them. I had to meet them again at Book Expo because phone calls and emails just wasn't working. They were too busy. So the next year when they were autographing, I just said, write it in the back of the book, and Mark did. And that's a quote that I have on my website now. And it's something like, if you want to sell 14 million books like we have, buy and read this book. And they were referring, of course, to my 1001 Ways to Market Your Books, which they basically cut apart and pasted up on the wall and, you know, clicked off as they did things.
Wow.
And so now, you know, we're good friends. I mean, I just love sitting with Jack or Mark and talking for a while. And every year at Book Expo and at different other conferences, we'll meet. And I just love spending time with them. They both have good souls. And that's just building relationships. But it all started with, you know, them speaking first. And, you know, it goes from there. And you get a lot of relationships like that, the people that you meet for the first time. Like at JV Alert, I met Joel Kamm. And, you know, I knew about him for a good number of years. But I had no idea he was following me. And he says, you know, I must be one of your biggest fans. Okay, thank you. You know, again, why didn't you let me know sooner?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is.
So for the listeners out there who are going, okay, well, that's great, but he's John Kramer. He's got all these people who already know who he is. How am I supposed to build relationships? What would you tell them?
Well, I didn't start out as the John Kramer. I started out as, you know, a guy from a small town in Iowa, and I just started building relationships. I kept knocking on doors. And the key thing, I think, to creating relationships, especially with media or online, is how much are you willing to give? You know, if you're willing to share, if you're willing to give, then you can create relationships. I mean, almost all of my media relationships are based on me giving them things, being open to doing an interview, even if they never mention my book. You know, and the person that was the New York Times reporter, she never did a story on me. But she kept asking me about, are there good people, are there good stories out there? I want stories about small publishers who are doing wonderful things. And I tell her, here, check out these people. But as a result of that, I got numerous calls from other reporters at New York Times that were doing stories. And that's how you start to build a relationship. And you really do have to get out there and give and share. I mean, the key thing, you know, on Twitter, I think, in terms of creating relationships, you know, everybody's saying, okay, get 19,000 followers in 1 month, you know, by doing these, you know, spammy things, you Mm-hmm. And I go, okay, you know, that's fine, but that isn't what I want. You know,
right.
In my experience, you build followers by posting interesting posts. And then over time, people start retweeting you and expose you to their audience. And people then say, hey, I want to check out that person. Because many of the people that I followed have been people that I've discovered because somebody else tweeted about them, or I saw them in somebody else's Twitter stream. And I'm always checking out. When I first started with Twitter, I would follow anybody, but now I don't because there's too many people spamming. And so, you know, I will not follow, you know, sex goddesses. I will not follow the people that obviously have an automatic Twitter stream that's being fed from some RSS feed. I will not follow anybody that thinks that Gary McCaffrey has a great idea. I'm sorry, I don't like people that spam in Twitter, who do junk Twitter streams. I know that they're hoping that they'll sell things that way, but to me, the way that you're going to get my attention and get me to weigh down money is if you give me some good content. If you give me some reason to follow you and to pay attention to you. And that's probably more important than the followers, is who's paying attention to you. Because that's where relationships happen. So, you know, the whole emphasis on how many followers do you have, to me, isn't important. What's important is how many people do you have paying attention to what you're doing.
Absolutely. And that's one thing I really like about your approach, is you're talking about what can you give, how can you serve, and having that as the primary focus.
Well, in my own experience, it's, you know, whatever you give comes back to you multifold. And I'm a firm believer in that. I don't think it's a one-to-one thing, you know, like for every action there's a reaction. Because in giving, it seems to be that for every giving action, there's a multiple reaction coming back to you. And so the more you give, the more you get. But you don't give to get. You give simply because that's in your heart to do. If you give to get, you're not doing it right. You're not giving then. You're really just trying to get. And the minute you start grasping for things, I think you lose sight of what it's all about, which is really building and nurturing relationships.
So let's say, John,
I do short answers, so, you know, every once in a while I do stop. You know?
That's what
you're supposed to jump in and ask a question.
Well, I don't want to jump over Rhonda, so I was going to let her take the lead. So go ahead, Rhonda.
No, that's cool. So, John, as you talk about giving, then if somebody is out there and they're going, but what could I possibly give to some big name, you know, like a Mark Victor Hansen, or what could I possibly give to somebody that I don't even know? What would be your answer to that?
Well, one of the ways I would start online is I would comment on their blog posts. That's always valuable to anybody, no matter how famous they are. The interaction with the people, you know, the worst thing in the world can be that you're blogging and nobody's responding or commenting. You know, that's not as much fun. The interaction is what is fun. What are people saying? How are they responding? Is what you're writing interesting to them or not? And so any time that you can respond to them and say, hey, I noticed this, and I have something to add to it, that's worthwhile. I think it's true even with major media. You know, a lot of major media, certainly all the magazines, allow you to write editors to the editor. Letters to the editor. and that means that they really want you to comment on their stories, and then they feature a certain number of those. It doesn't matter if they feature you, but the fact that you've written about and commented on what they're doing is incredibly valuable to them, and they do pay attention to it. And, you know,
absolutely.
I think that's true for anybody that's still, you know, especially online people that are doing blogs or posting YouTube videos. I mean, I love it when I post a YouTube video and somebody comments on it. You know, I like that. When I write a blog post and somebody comments on it, I like that. And, you know, so it's great feedback. And I don't see anybody, no matter how famous they are, not paying attention to that in some way. And if you tell them something really interesting, at some point, they start to pay real attention to you. I know one lady that got to be a blogger on Huffington Post, which right now is, I think is still invitation only, but she was commenting on the blog post of somebody else. And they were smart comments, and the blogger noticed and said, would you like to blog on Huffington Post? Now, that invitation would not have happened if the person hadn't started by creating the relationship in the first place.
Absolutely.
And
so you're a big blogger,
you know,
too, aren't
you? Reach out. You know, you have to reach out. You have to pick up the phone and make that call, send out that email, comment on their blog post, Twitter to them. If you see somebody famous on Twitter, you know, do the @, you know, JV Queen and write to her. You know, I know that Gina will pay attention to it.
Absolutely.
You know, that's the one thing that I follow more than anything else. You know, the direct messages on Twitter, I look at, but I pay more attention to who's RTing me or who's, you know, sending an @ John Kramer message. Because I do pay attention to those. I read every one of those.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like me, you probably have some sort of a tweet beep or some sort of an alert coming so you can't miss them, right?
I do. I have several alerts coming so I can do that. And obviously you can follow a lot of them just through Twitter itself. But I do like to have the tweet beep as well because sometimes people don't spell your name right or... they'll just use your name and not the @, so, you know, Twitter doesn't pick those up automatically, though you can do a search at any time. But I have I have a TweetBeat alert and I have a TweetLater alert, and it's amazing how different they are, you know.
It is, isn't it? I have both as well, and I also have a Google alert.
You'd think they'd pick up the same ones, you know. You'd think they were using the same API, you know, software, whatever, that Twitter, you know, provides, but somehow they do pick up different things. And some pick up things quicker than others. And so it's nice to see that. I mean, I've seen TweetBeat send me a message of, within about 5 minutes of somebody, you know, RTing me. It just happened to coincide at the right time, apparently. But it's amazing, you know, and it's neat to get those alerts because then you make sure you don't ignore anybody.
And for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, go to TweetBeep, TweetBeep.com, TweetBeep.com, and TweetLater, TweetLater.com. They're both free. They will both send you alerts for any words that you ask them to send you alerts for. You want to get a TweetBeep or a TweetLater alert for your name, for your ID in Twitter, for your company name or your brand, or anything that might indicate that somebody's trying to talk with you so that you can then follow up on it.
And one of the things I like about TweetLater is that it allows me to tweet later, which means schedule tweets. And I like that because I'm a late night person, so, you know, this is actually pretty early for me. You know, it's 10 a.m. Mountain Time, but I'm sometimes still sleeping then because, you know, but I still can tweet early in the morning, which is a good time to tweet. Like, you know, people say the best time to tweet is around 8 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. That's when the most people are on Twitter. I don't know if that's true or not, but I schedule some tweets for that time just so that people that are paying attention to Twitter streams then will get something from me.
Well, and it's funny because I hear that
doing
too.
That is that somebody will think that you're actually there and will try to converse with you.
Right.
And then 6 hours later, I see that they tried to converse with me, and I converse back with them, and they're not there, you know. But eventually, it catches up with you, and you start a relationship. I mean, I ended up having a short-time relationship with reporter, another reporter, a business reporter at New York Times, who's on Twitter. And I happened to see his Twitter stream, and I commented on it. And he said, I'd love to do a story with you on blah, blah, blah. Now, it never ended up happening, but it could have, I suppose, if I had aggressively followed up on it. I'm not an aggressive follower-upper. If somebody says they want to do something with me, I expect them to follow up, you know. But if Oprah calls, I'm going to call her back.
If she tweets you, you probably tweet her back too, right?
I'll tweet her back, yes. Actually, everybody that calls me, I try to call back. Everybody that tweets me or emails me, I try to respond to. But sometimes, you know, that gets to be very hard when you're busy. And, you know, I get about 500 emails a day. About 200 of those I actually have to respond to. That takes time. And some days I just don't have the time to do it. And so then it gets backlogged, and then maybe 3 weeks later I say, have I responded to you? It happens. And that's why one thing that's real important, you know, if you are trying to create a relationship with somebody who's busy or famous, you can't assume that just because you sent them one letter or one email or one tweet
right.
that they've ignored you. They may just have been busy that day. It's amazing. I mean, you know, the typical media editor is getting anywhere from 200 to 500 news releases a day. Now, they may have loved your news release, and then maybe they set it aside to do something with. But that day, something else happened, and they couldn't get to it, and then it got to the bottom of the pile. And a good story that they wanted to do something with got lost. But the reason it got lost is because you never followed up with them. You assume because they never responded to you that they didn't want a relationship with you. And the reality is they did, but they were too busy at that particular time to do something. And that happens all the time, especially with famous people or busy people. And generally speaking, the people you want relationships with are famous or busy. You know?
Yeah,
so
sure.
you have to knock on their door more than once if you really want to get their attention and create a relationship with them. And the reality is that in many cases, they'll be happy to do something with you. I mean, it's amazing how many times I know of people that have internet radio shows who will call up somebody famous and the person says, sure, I'd be happy to do an interview with you. And everybody's shy to ask.
Yeah, because they're thinking, oh, well, they're too big, they're too busy or whatever. But you never know until you ask, and you never know until you make that opening gesture what's going to come of it.
Yeah, and even then, it's not just the opening gesture, it's the ongoing gesture.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like a door-to-door salesperson. They never make any sales if they don't knock on the door, you know, and sometimes they knock loudly, you know. People can't respond to you if you don't initiate something. There's nothing to respond to.
I
there's a story that goes around sometimes on the internet and things like that, and somebody says, you know, they get to heaven and they say, why didn't you ever talk to me, God? And God says, well, why didn't you ever talk to me? You know, it starts somewhere. You know, I'm busy. Why didn't you respond? You got to start somewhere, you know. It's one of those things.
Well, I remember one of the first reasons I ever came across your name was by coming to your website looking for statistics. You have some of the most interesting statistics about internet traffic and what it can do. And I remember seeing the site, is it 10 million eyeballs? Is that the one that you've got?
Yes.
That just really has some unique perspectives on what can you do if 10 million people were to see your site. And it really is 10 million people that are going to potentially be building relationships with you. Can you really possibly manage all those relationships?
No, obviously you can't on one level, but Oprah's doing it. I mean, everybody that watches Oprah really does feel they have a relationship with her. She doesn't technically have a relationship with them in one sense, but she does. I mean, she really does try to serve her audience. And what she's doing in her show is a combination of what she wants to do and what her audience wants her to do. I got an interesting tweet. I was just checking on Twitter, and my sister's listening to the show.
Oh, how nice.
That's kind of neat.
Welcome.
She made a comment on that.
That's really great. Well, I know my dad's listening, too, so, Dad, I hope you figured out Twitter. My dad had a stroke over the weekend, and I was talking to him Sunday as he was recovering in the hospital, and he says, you know, I've been trying to figure out this Twitter thing, and I searched all over the place, and all I want to know is really simple. How do you make a tweet happen? And he hadn't figured that out yet because he was looking on his profile page, not his home page, so he couldn't see the box up at the top.
Yeah. Well, you know, Twitter isn't that clear. I mean, it does take a while to figure it out. There's no problem. You know, that's very clear. My sister just direct messaged me and said, stop doing the you knows.
Too funny.
So apparently I'm doing a bunch of you knows. I apologize for that.
That's okay. I'm doing the so's instead of the you knows. So between the two of us, so you know.
So you know. What can we tell you so you know?
Oh, too funny.
Well, I was listening to radio the other day, Michael Reagan's show, and I was amazed that when he's off script, he does incredible numbers of us. Because I was listening the day that Michael Jackson died, and every time he talked about Michael Jackson, because it wasn't part of his script, he was going, Michael Jackson is in the hospital, and it was like that. I was going, this guy is not, how can he be on radio? But then if you listen to the rest of his radio show, when he's on script, when he knows what he's, you know, when something is there, I did a you know, oh my gosh. When he's on script or when he knows what he's talking about, he's very clear and the odds don't appear. But when he's talking about an immediate news story, the odds just go everywhere and he keeps repeating words and it just went on like that. And I'm going, how could he be on radio? But when he's on script, he's fine. So it's an interesting phenomenon there. I don't know always how that works. But the thing is, you can't worry about that. You know, there I went again with another you know. Suddenly I'm aware of all those you knows, you know.
You're going to be subconscious of it now. Gee, thanks. Do it to him live on the radio. It's a whole bunch for that, right?
That's why I'm not a radio show host, you know. There I go again. I did it again.
We should have somebody in the chat count them for us. How funny.
I don't know how I'm going to stop them, because they obviously just sneak out.
Well, here's the neat thing about that, John. It's not important for you to stop them at all. We are all still going to have relationships with you even after the show is over, and you go on and you stop doing your you knows. Whether you do them or not doesn't matter. It's all about making that connection in the first place.
It's a key thing that, you know, when people worry about, I think I did another you know there. When people are worried about, oh, I can't be on TV or I can't be on radio, I don't know how to do it, I get nervous, I can't get in front of an audience, I don't know how to speak. But the thing is that most of us are very forgiving. We simply want good information or inspiration. Tell us a story and we'll be happy. And if you throw in a couple you knows or us or does or whatever, it doesn't matter.
Exactly. Well, Rhonda just got lost. Call back in as a host, Rhonda. So I'm hoping everyone is still hearing us because right now it's saying waiting for host to call in. So with any luck at all, I can get Rhonda to come back in as a host so that we can make sure that the show is still going on. I'm hoping everybody can hear us.
That
I can hear you, so that should be good. Boy, that's weird. Well, let's wait and see what happens with Rhonda. Somebody will chat us a question.
Something like that happens in blocked internet radio shows or in teleconferences. Something happens, a little glitch in technology, a lightning strike somewhere, something like that.
Well, Rhonda was calling in through Skype, and I think that's what did it, was Skype somehow dropped her call.
Okay.
So if she doesn't come back in a minute, I'll call in on another phone just to take over that host slot just so that there's somebody in there. There she is.
Hey, I'm sorry about that, folks. I got dropped. I'm glad the show went on. My goodness. Okay.
I think we were still okay because I could still hear John and John could still hear me. And if you didn't call back in a few minutes, I would have called in myself on a phone. So.
Okay. Well,
all we did was talk about all the secrets of Rhonda.
We did.
I'm sure that you did. I have no trouble believing that.
So, John, I would be terribly remiss if we had you on as a show and I didn't ask this question. If you're an entrepreneur and you've got any kind of a business, what is the best kind of business that you should really consider? I've got to have a book.
I think everybody that runs a business should have a book. Is that what you're asking, or what's the question?
That is exactly what I'm asking. And why?
A book really adds legitimacy to you as an expert. People think it's hard to write a book. I don't know why they think that, but they do. The fact is, a book isn't hard to write, but it takes time. And creating a book of 100 pages to 500 pages, people think, oh, this person really knows what they're writing about. And that means that, let's say that you run a hardware store and you have a book about building outdoor decks. Well, if I'm going to be building an outdoor deck and I read your book, I'm going to go shop at your place because I know I'll be able to ask some questions of you. Well, what do I do at this juncture in building my deck? And I know that you'll probably answer me. Whereas if I go to Home Depot, I don't know if they will. Now, chances are they will. Home Depot has a good customer service department. But if Joe Smith from Joe's Hardware writes a book and it's in my town, I'm going to be shopping there.
It's funny that you used the Handyman Hardware kind of example because that was actually somebody that I was thinking of just now. He has a website called youronlinehandyman.com. He has a handyman business in Long Island. And I agree, he should have a book. One of my clients, did you? Good job, Rhonda. One of my clients is a woman that has a coaching business. She's teaching coaches. She's teaching entrepreneurs. She's got plans for having a TV show. She's trying to get that put together right now. She knows she needs a book, but the idea of writing a book is one that she's just not good with. And she keeps saying, well, the only way I'm going to have her have a book is if I hire a ghostwriter.
It can be that, but she could also simply do a number of interviews. I mean, if she wants to create a book very quickly, just create a blog talk radio show, do a bunch of interviews.
She has one.
And then transcribe them and make a book out of it. You hire an editor to make it, take out all the you knows.
And the so's.
And all those, whatever else that might be there. But you can then make a good book. And it'd be a perfectly legitimate book because in an interview, it's not just the person who's being interviewed that's giving knowledge and sharing stuff. It's also the person who's doing the interview.
And the format of her show is a little bit different than the format that we use here. She has guests on who interview her on each episode. So the actual content of the show is actually her.
Yeah, so she has a book already, probably. If she's done 10 shows, she's got a book.
She's done more than that. She's probably got 30 or 40 episodes out there.
Okay,
she's got three
so
or four
her
books.
Her book is done.
Exactly. Yep.
Now, the good thing to do at that point would be to hire a good editor. And I have a whole list of editors on my website if somebody needs that, bookmarket.com/101edit.htm. And there's a list of good book editors. and you'll find one there that you'd have a good relationship with and you'd want to have, you know, to do
yep.
that. I did another you know there. Boy, I'm becoming aware of that now.
Oh, too funny.
Yeah.
And
so all she's got to do is get on out of it.
My sister tweeted and said that everybody could hear us. So.
Oh, good. Thank you.
And when Rhonda left us, people could hear us.
Good, good, good. Oh, Twitter's just an amazing thing, isn't it? I'm sitting here looking at the chat, and you're getting it through Twitter. Wonderful. So now she's got her editor.
I did another you know there. I'm being very aware of that.
Oh, poor Don.
But the interesting thing is, you know, with, there I did another one. With Twitter, you can actually create interactive audience, even as you're doing something like this, Blog Talk Radio. Now, does Blog Talk Radio have an they don't have an interactive...
It does. There's a chat. But honestly, I have very few people that actually type in the chat. Same exact thing happens to me when they want to interact. They tweet me. They don't chat me.
And that's
right.
Fine, you know, because oh, there I did another one. I apologize, Rita. Rita, that's my sister. Those you knows are obviously bothering her.
They're not bothering me.
No, they're not bothering me either. I've missed most of them that you caught yourself on, so it's just not a big issue in my in universe.
No, it probably isn't. It's just I'm aware of it now. It's really interesting. I must do it a lot in all my interviews. I
too
would
funny.
Correct that somewhat.
So let's go back to my client who now has her book from all of her teleconferences and her radio shows. She's got an editor, so the editor's working on getting it into a book. Well, what comes next? Now she's got this book, but doesn't it have to do something? Doesn't she have to do something with it?
Well, at some point you'll want to publicize it, possibly do some speaking somewhere, especially in her local area, or maybe do a blog tour or something like that. Maybe do a series of video interviews on YouTube that will draw, you know, people to be interested in what she's doing. Things like that.
Is it going to be expensive for her to actually get her book in print?
No, because you can use something like Lulu or CreateSpace or Infinity Publishing. For a couple $100, you can have a book out, and in many cases, for less than that. I think Lulu.com is like $60 to do a setup of a book. And of course, you have that means a print-on-demand book. That means the book is printed as people order it, and people can then order such a book on Amazon.com or Lulu.com, and that or on your website, because obviously you would have a link on your website as well to the book. Now, at some point, if you have a big enough audience, you would want to go to an offset printer, and what I call a real book printer, and have them print 1,000 copies or 2,000 copies, and then be able to sell them direct to Amazon and get them into bookstores. Bookstores, for the most part, still don't like print-on-demand books. So if you want to get your book in bookstores, you need to print copies in with an offset printer, probably. And again, if you have to find offset book printers, I have a whole list of those, again, on my website at bookmarket.com.
I had a feeling.
Mark,
no.
John has such fabulous resources at bookmarket.com for anybody who is thinking about writing a book or wants to know things. Even, I mean, it's a great page of resources about Twitter and all kinds of things about editing and publishing and writing, and it's just a fabulous, fabulous resource.
It really is. Google considers it an authority site. It has a page rank of, I think, 5 or 6. It's a tremendous wealth of information. I use their site often. I have for years. So thank you for having such great info on it, John, because I've known about you because I've used your site just for research and for sharing information with my students long before you and I ever met or even talked via email.
Right. The purpose, you know, for the website, for me, it's basically my Rolodex online. There's also, you know, a lot of resource pages and things like that. But the main thing is that it's my Rolodex. It's what I use when I'm consulting with people and things like that. So when somebody asks me a question, can you recommend a good publicist, I can go to my list of book publicists And I could say, here, why don't you try these three people? They all specialize in cookbooks. And I can go on the page and I can easily do a quick find to find anybody that's doing cookbooks or novels or business books and give people recommendations really quickly, much more quickly than I could if I had it all in a database somewhere.
Well, we're in the middle of moving our servers, and the IM University and the 30-Day IM Challenge are on one server, and we're getting ready to move them over to Amazon. And I learned something this week that shocked the heck out of me. Don't know why it did, but it did. I have a 200-gigabyte hard drive for the IM University and for the 30-Day IM Challenge. And I'm thinking, you know, take a couple hours, somebody will move the sites, no big deal. And it's taken a couple of weeks, and I'm going, you know, why is it taking so long? Well, when I realized that I am within 5 gigabytes of maxing out the storage space on a 200-gigabyte hard drive, it just about blew me away. And like you, it's the exact same reason. It is my Rolodex. I'm consulting, I'm teaching, I'm whatevering, and everything goes up on the website. Oh, here you go. Let me put this up for you. Oh, here you go. Let me put this up for you. The thing of it is that mine is not organized the way that yours is, where there's links off the side and nice, neat little navigation pages. So I just did a workshop this weekend, and the workshop was one called the Info Product Systems Workshop, where I was sharing not how to create an info product from a tactical perspective, not how to write a book, but the strategies and the strategic side of information publishing. And one of the bonuses that I gave them was what I call my AskGGG database. All my redirect links are in a site called AskGGG.com, and there's probably close to 5,000 of them. All that stuff that's on my hard drive, on my server, is all cross-linked and whatnot through these links, plus probably a couple thousand of those are links out to other people's websites, too. So I'm in the process of organizing all of those links so that people can actually use them rather than just get an Excel spreadsheet. And I'm amazed myself at how much information I've accumulated since I've been online back all the way back to 97, 12 years, because all of it is on those two websites in some way, shape, or form. And if you've been around for a few years and you really take the time to take all that stuff that you'd put in a Rolodex and put it onto a web page instead, you accumulate a lot of stuff over time, don't you, John?
You do. And with me, I'm always adding to each page. That's one reason that I like not using blogging software for my website, is that it's easier for me to change and update pages on my own, in my own organization. The thing with blogging software, it's hard to organize your site in a way that makes it easy for people to find all the information. They can always use search, but it's harder to organize it.
I think the opposite is true for me. For me, it's so much easier to organize in a blog.
Okay, you're using the blogging software differently than I am then, I guess.
Yeah, I use WordPress as opposed to Blogger. And
I use WordPress for one of my sites, too, but I still find it not that easy to organize, 300, 400, 500 pages.
We'll have to chat about that, because there is a specific strategy to it.
Okay.
And
yeah,
the way that I do it is with parent and children pages and posts.
Right.
So that it can be organized much the way yours is right now. If you mouse over one of the navigation buttons on the left-hand side, another sub-navigation thing comes up. You can do the same exact thing inside of a blog, and the beauty of it when you're doing it in a blog is that the search engines perceive it differently. So if you're doing it on just a web page, the search engines don't always see deep links, so page A links to page B, page B links to page C links to page D, and so on. And those deep links are what causes your site to become an authority site in the eyes of the search engine. Well, obviously, you've done it the right way because you do have an authority site. for most people, that's kind of tricky. They don't understand the technology behind how you make that happen, and a blog can make that easier to do.
Okay.
And so for me, I'm not great with HTML. It's super easy to make that really deep set of links occur throughout a blog.
Oh, well, that's good to know, because I get a lot of people that, you know, want to do a website and they don't know what to do. A website, creating their own website, is too complicated. And I tell them, well, start with a blog. But now what you're telling me is that using WordPress, that's the one you use, right?
Exactly.
That it's fairly easy to use.
Really easy. If you can use Microsoft Word, you can make an entire website organized as well as yours is just using WordPress. And it's as complicated as knowing Microsoft Word. It's that difficult.
Okay.
Right.
Now, I've learned how to use HTML, so I tend to create pages using, right now I still use Front Page.
I do too.
But I use, you know, I still go in and edit a lot of it in HTML, because a Front Page tends to be kind of, what would you say, they like to
bulky.
Use a lot more extra characters than they need to convey the information the way you want it to.
They do. And WordPress doesn't have that. So WordPress, when you're using it, it's a WYSIWYG editor, essentially. It's just like using Microsoft Word. You want to change the color? Same way you do it in Microsoft Word. Highlight it and pick the color. You don't have to know any HTML to make it work.
And Front Page allows you to do that, too. I still like to go in and edit it sometimes because of the wordiness of it. That's just
I do, too.
And I've found over the years that, you know, it really doesn't matter because the pages still load fast. So I probably shouldn't be making the HTML so tight, but I still do it sometimes.
Well, obviously you're doing something right, because the search engines love your site.
They do.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one thing that's real important to me. I have a page where I actually list my ranking on Google for about 120 different terms related to marketing and publishing and publicity, and I'm in the top 10 in about 120 different key terms.
Wow, that's fabulous.
Those are the ones I've thought about. And there are things like, you know, if you type in sportsbook editor, I'm one of the top ones in Google. I don't know what page I'm on now, but at one point I was like number one or number two in Google if you typed in sportsbook editors. And that's because I have a page devoted to sportsbook editors.
Right.
And so I became, you know, I'm number one and number two under sportsbook editors.
Interesting.
And I don't edit sports books. I don't publish sports books. I think I'm probably number one or number two also under publishers. And again, I'm not the publisher. So one of the ways that, again, I'm number one under sports book publishers, you can look at other things, and I'm that way too. And the reason is because I created an authority page on sports book publishers. And so a lot of the reasons that I rank in so many ways is because I have a page devoted to it that Google recognizes as the best page for that particular keyword term. Now, there are other things, like if you try to optimize for some word like internet marketing, wow, that's not going to work.
Yeah, just a little too much competition for that.
Yeah, you know,
right.
But, you know, I think I was on some other terms. For internet marketing book, I'm number 7 and 8. And I'm the only person on the that first page that has two listings.
Oh, interesting.
And I'm not sure why. It's going to my book-related pages, and somehow it picked it up. But it is hard to optimize for terms that are really competitive. Those things are very hard to do. But it's still amazing, you know. I think a word like book marketing is competitive, but again, I've been number one and number two under that term for many, many years.
Well,
my social network now is number three after my website.
The trick I've always found for making that really work and turn into actual traffic, and hopefully traffic that buys, is to take whatever the base word is and go do some keyword research around that base word. And I like to use one of two keyword tools. I like to either use Click Ad Equalizer, or I like to use something called it's a free keyword tool that you can find at askggg.com/free-keyword-tool. So if I'm looking at book marketing, for example, I'll just go put in the word book, and I will then go through all of the different keywords related to the word book to come up with the ones that have the fewest number of competitors and the greatest numbers in terms of the demand, because you want to look at both the supply and the demand, just like any other economic equation. And so often I'll see students who are just getting started, and they will be going out and they'll look in Google or they'll look in Yahoo and they'll go, wow, there's 650 million pages in here. People are really searching for this like crazy. And I'll go look it up in one of the keyword tools, and there are 2 searches per month for it. Well, that's because you're looking at the supply, you're not looking at the demand. So you've really managed to go out and find the words that have the least amount of supply, the greatest amount of demand, and put together a page to capitalize on them.
Yes, and for that you do need to use one of the keyword tools, and they really do help. I think that one of the things that people are discovering is that it's not always important to be the top for internet marketing, but if you be internet marketing for dummies or internet marketing expert or internet marketing some other keyword, then that may make a difference. You're probably fairly highly rated for internet marketing university.
I am. I'm usually either number one, number two, or number three. We flip-flop. So, Beck, when I first started the IM University, my site, am I number one today? Great. My site has a but in the front of it. Marlon Sanders owned the domain name IM University without the. And he didn't have a site on it. He had owned it for like 7 years, had never put a site on it. So I said, you know, put the on it. I'll go put my site out. Well, within 60 days, I started getting traffic looking for IM University, Internet Marketing University, and Marlon's site, too. And boom, his site went up, too. So now we flip-flop back and forth between us, and that's pretty neat.
Yeah.
That's funny.
It does matter what the name of your site is, I think. It does make a difference. Though back when I started, I didn't get bookmarketing.com. I got bookmarket.com. Because I was naive enough when I started to think that there was a 10-character limit. That's why I went with Bookmarket. And it's still handy in some ways because it's shorter, but I do sort of miss not having bookmarketing.com. Somebody else has that now. Somebody had it at one point and offered it to me for $1,000, but I didn't really care at that point because my site was the site.
Wow. Well, and your name is important, I agree. And for us, the IM University, so many people make the mistake of thinking it's the Instant Messaging University, and they go, wow, there's even a university for instant messaging now. And I'm like, no, that's not quite it. And what I teach is only in part internet marketing. In fact, it's really the smallest part. So this week, tomorrow, we're actually changing our name. And our new name is going to be Directions University instead of Internet Marketing University because it really fits what we do better. And what we really do is we help you find direction in your life, direction for your business, give direction to your customers, and as a result of those three, really help create direction for the world, and it's so much more akin to what we really teach. That does not mean the IM University domain name is going to go away, because we do teach as part of that internet marketing. But we also teach joint ventures and mindset and all these other things. So we're going to have some other schools within Directions University that will be a part of it, mostly for search engine purposes, more than anything else.
Okay, great.
So I'm really excited about it. The name change for us, I think, is one that we should have had a while ago that will really help bring everything that we do in Directions University together. But I know a book is something that's certainly on my plate for 2010. I will not let 2010 go by without getting one.
What about 2009?
Well, 2009, we got to get Directions University out there and whatnot. So I've already started working on the book. It's probably about halfway done. And right around January-ish is when I'm looking at trying to get it out there. So that's what's going to be on my plate for all of 2010.
Oh, okay. Great. You have my system to help you and John's marketing tactics to help you. So,
which is wonderful. Now, the marketing tactics that you teach and that you help your clients with, they work for a lot more than just a book, right?
Yes. In fact, many people have written to me and said, 1001 Ways to Market Your Books is the best book on marketing I've ever read. And they're
wow.
in a wholly different area. And I think that that's fine. I'm happy with that. It is very, very specific to book publishing, but there's enough there that anybody who's marketing anything can learn a lot. And I really designed it to be that way. I wanted to universalize it, but I did at the same time want to talk specifically to my main audience, which was book authors and book publishers. And so I really do focus on that, and I'm very U.S.-centric. So I've had publishers ask for rights in China, Korea, Israel, Brazil, et cetera, et cetera. And actually had people pay me for the rights, but I've never seen a book come out yet.
Interesting.
One of the
mistakes I see people make often when they think about writing a book is that they believe that when they have a book and they can get their book out to millions of people, that book sales are going to bring them money. Can you comment on that and elaborate a bit? Because I don't see that as being where the money comes from.
Selling books can bring you money, but where the money really is what do you have as a follow-up product? Do you have other books? Do you have courses? Do you have coaching? Do you have a speaking career? Other things like that really do make a difference, and it's where you actually make a living. Very few people make a living just writing books. I think, you know, different times I've heard statistics on it, and the professional authors associations have said that their typical member sells maybe 5,000 books a year, makes $5,000 a year.
Wow.
Writers, and they're only making $5,000 a year. That was amazing. Now, that was about 15 years ago, and I haven't heard any statistics since, but...
But still, that's way low, even 15 years ago.
Yes, and again, any professional group is going to include a lot of amateurs that have written one or two articles, because you can join like the science fiction writers if you've had three short stories done. Well, you don't. That's like $500. So you
maybe
can say you're professional, but you're not really professional yet. And the, you know, the way I define somebody as a professional writer is that they're making a living at it.
Mm-hmm.
And
so which comes first, the book or the other stuff?
It can go either way. If you're an active consultant, obviously at some point, or an active speaker, you're going to write a book. I know very few active speakers or consultants who don't end up writing a book at some point. And they understand that the book is going to help them build their career even more. If you go to the professional, NSA, the National Speakers Association, the professional group, they will all tell you, you got to have a book if you're going to be a speaker and get any kind of money out of it. Because the people that are hiring you don't want to hire you if you don't appear to be an expert. And one of the ways that you'll appear very quickly to be an expert is by having a book.
Yes.
And the amazing thing is that if you're a speaker, I mean, gee, you have a book already. Because a talk, a good speech, you know, it's an hour-long speech, can be very easily fleshed out into a book. It's just a
Definitely.
Matter of adding more stories.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's all you need is that mind of a storyteller that I always talk about, and you add those stories and connect the dots for people and how those stories can assist them in creating whatever outcome it is that you're delivering to them. And that plus your material, you have a great book.
And that's what you help, Rhonda, that's what you help people with, right?
Yes, I do. I have a system that makes it very easy to write a book that grows your business. I mean, not just any old book, but one that really, truly does grow your business. And the way that I teach it, just as we're talking about, is that before you ever sat down and put pen to paper or fingers to keyboard for the book, it's knowing where they're going afterwards and setting up the vision for your business, so that, because the real money is coming from everything else.
The typical print-on-demand book sells 100 copies. So obviously you're not going to make any money that way. And I don't always, you know, there's some people that go out there and teach people you should self-publish because you'll make more money. And I don't really see the evidence for that. Yes, if you know what you're doing and you've got a built-in audience, self-publishing, you'll make more money than if you sell to a big publisher, if you have the built-in audience. But if you don't, and you don't, then you need a big publisher perhaps to get the distribution to help expose you to a larger audience. But the reality is today, there's no publisher in the world that wants you if you don't have what they call a platform. And a platform means that you already have a built-in audience. At that point, it starts to become, okay, do I self-publish or do I publish? If I have to build the platform anyway, maybe I should just self-publish. And again, I think it depends on how large your audience is. The bigger the audience, the more mass market it is, I think the more important it is to possibly sell your book to a good publisher. But only if they're enthusiastic about the book. If they're lukewarm about the book, if you're having to force them to publish it, it's not a good relationship. But if they really want to do it and they're excited about it and they're going to really do a lot of work in promoting it, then selling your rights makes sense. So there are different options in terms of publishing, and you have to choose which one's going to be best for your particular book. The worst thing that can happen is you sell your book to a publisher and they make it a C-list book, which means it's really unimportant, because then nothing's going to happen, and then you're stuck. They have control of the book. You're not getting any sales, and you're having to make all the sales anyway. At that point, self-publishing makes sense. But if you're what they call an A-list book, that means one of the books they're really going to promote, then it might be worthwhile to sell to a publisher. And the way you know is how much do they offer you in advance.
How difficult is it to get a publisher to do that?
How do you get them to do that?
How difficult is it to get them to do that?
It's pretty difficult if you don't if you haven't built up a platform. But if you're a professional speaker and you're speaking to a lot of corporations every year, or you're doing the Unity Church Circuit or something like that, and you've built up, and you're speaking to 100 or 200 or 500 people at a time, you have an audience. A publisher is going to be interested in your book. Now, whether they'll make it an A-list book depends on how well you sold them on the idea that your book could be a big seller. And that's really your challenge. You have to build in the mind of the publisher and the editor at the publisher that your book is going to be a hit. You got to convince them of that, or they're not going to be excited. And one of the ways you convince them is you tie it into other books that have already been successful and show how your book is bigger, better, more wonderful, something like that, that gives them the idea that, oh, since the Da Vinci Code sold so well and this book is the next Da Vinci Code, maybe we should publish it. Now, the fact of the matter is there was a best-selling book a number of years ago. I'm going blank on it. Bridges of Madison County. It was the number one bestseller for like 2 years. So every new novel that was being brought out by a new author was called the next Bridges of Madison County. There were about 5,000 next Bridges of Madison County, and only about one of those ever made it to the bestseller list.
Wow.
Because they didn't live up to the promise in some way. It's really amazing. Two of the worst written novels in the last 20 years were also the two top best-selling novels, that being Bridges of Madison County, which is a terribly written novel, and The Da Vinci Code, which again was a very poorly written novel in terms of the thriller genre that it was. That's my own opinion, but I read them both, so, you know, I bought into it, but I thought they were very poorly written novels. But they still captured the imagination because both of them had a seed idea that worked.
Right.
And in nonfiction, it's sort of the same way. You've got to really come up with a good title. I think that's probably the most important thing in selling a book is what is the title of the book? Because it really does matter. And the key thing in a good book is that the title has to be memorable. People have to be able to remember it so they can pass it on to other people. Because 80% of books that are sold because of word of mouth.
That's what
the same thing with your domain name. It's got to be memorable, too.
People have to be able to remember it, and they have to be able to spell it.
Oh, yes.
That's for sure.
And that's why, you know, I'm comfortable with bookmarket.com. It works for me. Even though bookmarketing.com might be better now. But I like the short one because it works better when you're doing things like Twitter, where you have 140 characters. Now, you can always shorten the URL, and there's all kinds of techniques for doing that, but I like to have my brand name out there, so I like, when I can, to link to my website, the link with the full bookmarket.com.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Twitter sometimes automatically shortens it, which frustrates me, because I haven't figured out when they decide to automatically shorten it and when they decide to leave it.
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I couldn't help you there.
The one thing that I found that seems to work is to add some words after the URL, because then they're less likely to shorten it. If it's at the end, they tend to shorten it almost all the time.
And if I leave the HTTP off and just start with the www dot, they usually will leave it alone.
Yes, but then the people using TweetDeck can't click on the link.
Yeah, they can as long as the W's are in it.
Not without the HTTP. That's what somebody told me.
I use TweetDeck, and I can click on my own links as long as I have the W's. It's only an issue if I leave the W's off, too. So if I start with mydomainname.com without the W's, then it's not clickable. But with the W's, it is in TweetDeck.
Well, maybe it wasn't TweetDeck then, but somebody said they could not click on my links. So I started using the HTTP because they said that they couldn't get it wasn't a clickable link.
That's actually why I have the askggg.com domain name, is that it's only 6 characters and I use it for Twitter because it's so short.
Right. I think in Facebook they won't do if you use www, it won't automatically be linkable either.
I have to double-check that in Facebook. I know TweetDeck's okay, but there might be another tool that I'm just not aware of.
Yeah, so I started using the HTTPs. Anyway, that's maybe off the subject.
And you're right. At the end of, if you put text in at the end, but past the link, that does help too.
And I almost always do that.
One of those anecdotal things. I tested different things to try to find out what would work, and that seemed to be the thing that would work the most.
Mm-hmm.
The most times.
But sometimes even that doesn't work. But you're right. It will help more often than not.
Right.
And I don't know quite why they shorten it if it's within the 140 characters.
I've not figured that one out either.
Why they?
I've even read their whole FAQ page trying to find an answer to that and couldn't.
Wow, I'm glad somebody else has thought about that.
It bugged the heck out of me for a while. So, yes, I put a lot of thought into that, actually.
And the main reason is probably the same thing. You wanted your brand there.
Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely.
Most people are hesitant to click on a link that's going to, because they don't know where it's taking them.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So you can click on it and be taken to a sex page or a sales page, or you don't know what it is, and that's why I like to have the real link there whenever I can. But that's all part of branding. But the key thing, again, is with book titles, and I think websites, are they memorable? Can people remember? I think it's also true for, like, iPhone apps. you got to really have a clever name for the iPhone app if it's going to take off.
Well, it's all part of branding, I think.
Yeah.
What's one of the questions you're asked most often?
The one I'm probably asked the most often and is impossible to answer is the one where people say, can you give me ideas on how to market my book?
Oh, yeah, that's a toughie to answer,
isn't it? In general, how do you answer it and do justice to your own time? Because
right. That's
why I wrote the book, to answer that
question.
And so most of the time I have to answer it by saying, that's why I wrote the book. Please read the book and then come back to me with a specific question. Because I can answer specific questions in a few words probably by pointing them to somewhere or saying yes or no. But when they ask for something so general as how do I market my book, that takes 700 pages.
Right. And what's one of the best questions you've ever been asked?
Boy, it would probably be some sort of specific question that I could really answer for their particular book that would make a real difference to their book. And when I do consulting, that usually happens, that there's something that comes up in the questioning that takes us to a place that I wasn't even thinking of going. So the question helped me to bring out the thing that I just simply had forgotten at that time to tell them. So to me, the best question is the one that helps me to remind them to tell them something that I meant to, but I had forgotten.
Gotcha. So the questions that are really outcome-oriented, I would think.
Right.
Yes. I mean, the thing that I love best in helping people is to help them think about how to make their book a bestseller. That's the thing that's most fun for me. And because I've been tracking the industry for almost 30 years now, I really know what works for different kinds of books. And I can't, you know, I would love to be able to write a book and say, here's the answer. Here are the three things you need to do a bestseller. But the reality is that each book is a little bit different. Their audience is different. The subject is different. The timing is different. And so you have to really, that's one reason that even if you write the best book on the subject, people still want to often hire you as a consultant because you can apply what you know to their specific situation.
Yes.
And that's why you can give away everything you know in a book and people will still hire you as a consultant. I know some people that are afraid to put everything in the book because then nobody will hire them. Well, that's not the reality. It's true even for speaking. People will still hire you as a speaker even though you've said everything in the book because when you come to speak, hopefully you're going to add some new stories or you're going to add some perspective to their particular group. I always try to do that. I'm always aware of who I'm speaking to so that I can help them with what they're doing.
Well, and that's a hard one for people to get their heads around, too, especially when they're just starting out. So often they want to include in the book steps 1, 2, and 3 of a 10-step process. And steps 4 through 10 for, you know, the other stuff that they're going to make money on. And it doesn't work that way. If your audience feels that you're holding back those other steps, they're going to want what you have to sell them later, even less. You've got to learn to give all 10 steps, but at a high level, and sell them the detail.
Yes, I tell people that if you're doing a TV interview or a radio interview, you can't hold back. You can't say, well, that's my book.
Yes.
Because if you answer questions always with that answer, nobody's going to be interested in you because you haven't given them any reason to go look at the book. But when you start to give some really good advice, and even some specific advice, they're going to go, this person knows what they're talking about. I need to read their book. So you always, I think, should give as much as you can of good content. Because if you do that, people will want to go to your website, to your book, to whatever it is that you want to sell. And so you see that the most successful internet marketers, they'll have hour-long videos promoting their new product launch or something like that, and they're giving away real useful information. And the smart people are doing that. And even if you look at my sales page for the 10 Million Eyeballs course, and MillionEyeballs.com. I give some real information there. I tell you success stories. I give about 40 different success stories. If you look at that and you read between the lines, you know a lot. I mean, I'm giving away a lot of content there. If you don't know, you may not realize it. But if you know what I'm really talking about, you realize how much content I'm giving away on that sales page.
I've had that sales page bookmarked for a while just because of that. It's a really, really well-done sales page. There's so much information in it.
Yeah. You can learn something by reading that sales page, and it really is a course in marketing simply to read those success stories because they're not just John Kramer is great, but they're actual real outcomes, and if John Kramer is great, but they're but they're outcome-based. So you really can learn a lot from reading that site.
Well, I don't think John Kramer is great. It's going to sell anything, no?
No, it wouldn't.
I threw in another you know there.
Jack Canfield often says that one of his biggest mistakes in Chicken Soup for the Soul was that he had millions of copies sold before he ever thought about putting something in it that would allow him to build a list. What is one of the mistakes that you see being made repeatedly?
Well, one of the biggest mistakes I see made by book authors is they don't follow up.
Mm.
When they make contacts in publicity or internet marketing or anywhere, they don't follow up. And the reality is that if you don't follow up, the chances of getting a response are pretty slim. And that's just simply because people are busy, people have other things that interrupt what they're doing, and then they don't get back to it. And if you don't follow up, I mean, for me, when somebody sends me a press release, and I've lost so many good stories that I wanted to put in my newsletter simply because it got buried in a pile, and then the information became too old. And even though it was still good information, it was too old. I didn't want to use it then because I like new information. All of us media people do. But when people would follow up and say, I sent you my book or I sent the news release, I was wondering if you'd be able to use it, or they email me with that, I go back and I look at it and I put it at the top. And then the chances have increased by at least 1,000% that I'll do a story. Simply from one follow-up, think what happens if you do 2 or 3 follow-ups. Your chances increase that much more. I know one lady that was looking to get testimonials for her book from a lot of celebrities. She bugged the heck out of them until they surrendered. Now, there's a point between being obnoxious.
Right.
And a stalker. and being persistent. And the thing that I like best was a friend of mine, Joanna Lund, said, she called it velvet hammer marketing. It's that persistent sort of knocking on the door, offering something to the person you're asking for a response from. The key, I think, is you can't just ask for something from somebody, but you give them a reason to respond to you because you have something to offer their readers, their buyers, their website visitors, the people that are coming to their blog. If you can offer them some sort of good content, some sort of value, then they're going to be much more likely to respond or tolerate you asking something from them. So any time that I make an additional contact with a publicist, an editor or something like that, I'm going to be offering some sort of new insight, some sort of new content or a new perspective on the story idea that I sent them that makes it valid for me to contact them a second time. The worst thing that media people, and I think probably internet marketers or anybody with a website hates, is the person that says, why haven't you featured me yet? Why haven't you done anything with my book? It's so great. You know, and the thing is that the reason we haven't is because you haven't sold us yet. You haven't given us a reason to pay attention to you. Or we were busy. And it'll be one of those two reasons. And what you have to do is you knock on the door the second time, you give them another reason why they should be paying attention to you. And the main reason they should be paying attention to you is because you have something that's going to build their business or build their audience or going to do something like that. Like one of the things I teach in the 10 Million Eyeballs course, in fact, the first lesson is all about creating relationships. And I think that that's the most fundamental thing that you have to do in internet marketing is create relationships. And for that, you need to contact people and give them a reason to create a relationship with you. And in internet marketing, to me, it's so simple because any good website that's highly rated is highly rated because it has ongoing new content. And what you're offering them, if you do it right in contacting them, is you're offering them very good new content that will interest the people that come to their website. Now, who is going to say no to that?
Right.
Who's going to say, no, I don't want that new content? Anybody who's an authoritative website, a highly rated website, 90% of their content is not generated by them. It's generated from outside.
Right. We are just getting out of time here. It's amazing how quickly it can go.
I think we're out now, aren't we?
Yeah.
No, I think. Are we?
Yeah, we are. And it just is amazing, John, everything that you've shared. And yeah, it is. It's amazing that we're out of time.
Well, you know, I do 3-day seminars on this subject, so.
I know. Yes, you do. And you're going to be in Colorado soon, and you're just all over. And what a pleasure to have you share all of these great ideas for marketing, book marketing, relationship building here.
And let me just tell everyone where they can find you again. That's John Kramer at www.bookmarket.com and at 10millioneyeballs.com, and that's the word 10, T-E-N, millioneyeballs.com. John, I had a real blast here today. Thank you so much for being here with us. We did have one question that still got put into the chat that I missed earlier that says, what do you think of sending your book to famous authors? Even though that's not going to be in our recording, what do you think of sending your book to famous authors?
I think it's worthwhile because they might do a testimonial for you, and that's worthwhile. Plus, you start creating word of mouth. Even if they only read it themselves and never talk about it, they're probably going to tell a friend or two, hey, you know, if you're interested in building decks, I just got a great book on building decks. You know,
great.
You never know when people are going to talk to other people about a specific need.
Yes.
Most of my books are sold because of word of mouth. People are telling other people, hey, if you're writing a book, you need to read this book before you get around to publishing your book. And ideally, I like to capture authors when they're writing their book rather than when their book is off the press and now they say, how do I market the book? I'd rather capture the person who's working on the book and starting to write it, and they come to me and say, how can I market my book? And I don't care if it's not done, because I'm going to be teaching them things that will help them to make a better book so that when they're marketing and building the audience and building the platform so that when the book is ready to be published, they have the platform.
Right.
So people are already hungry for what they're writing about and what they're talking about. And
great.
The saddest thing to me is when people come to me and the book is off the press and the title is wrong or the cover is wrong, or they've done no marketing up to that point, and now they're saying, how do I market this book? And I say, well, you wasted 2 years. You could have been marketing the whole time you were writing the book.
Exactly.
Really good point. Well, John, thank you again. It has been my pleasure having you here. And, Rhonda, I am so glad you're going to be with me on the show every week from here on out. That's going to be great.
I'm excited. Thank you very much, John. Thank you so much. Real honor and real pleasure to have you here and to continue growing our relationship, and that you've always provided great resources and information. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, thanks, Dina. And I really enjoyed it. It's been fun. I always enjoy doing these interviews.
Great. If I can ever do anything for you at all, John, please don't hesitate to contact me.
Okay.
Same here.
I'll remember.
Great. Take care, guys. See you all next week here on Relationship Marketing 101. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.